Hey, I want to welcome everybody to the Sacramental Charismatic Podcast. My name is Luke Garrity, and I'm joined by Wes McLaughlin. And today we have a bonus episode, and we are going to be talking about Tim Keller, who recently passed away, a very well-known pastor, theologian, church planter, mentor, author, teacher. What else, Wes? What else would you add to him?
Cultural something on culture.
Yeah. Critic maker. And advocate. Yeah. Culture maker.
Culture maker. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably for him, probably important to mention husband, father, loved by many family members too. I don't want to dehumanize him as a church leader. But we're joined by another guest. Could you introduce your daughter?
Amelia, say hi. Say hi, Amelia. This is Amelia McLaughlin, Amelia Anaïe McLaughlin. She may be joining us on a few episodes. She is really into theology and the Bible, and she's already a sacramentalist. So I figured why not have her?
She's also an egalitarian, as she is going to probably someday be a preacher, and she listened to her mother preach on Mother's
Day.
Absolutely.
Yes, exactly. So she's going to give us her input when she feels like she's ready to, and we will listen to her.
Yes, it's true. Cutest movie ever. We're getting those clicks, those likes, those subscribes, and those shares.
Yeah.
To her. So, yeah. Well, jumping into, we're calling this a bonus episode. Just as an additional thing to throw on to the end of season 3, but your idea was to talk a little bit about Tim Keller. Maybe we could start by you sharing, how he impacted you and, why you felt it'd be fun to talk about him, for our podcast.
I think like 2 days before, Tim passed away, I was actually reading something of his that is probably not as well known publicly, at least, but it was his document on the sociological and cultural effects of churches at different growth sizes, at different sizes. And I was just reading it and thinking, wow, this is so great. And it's so helpful. And then he unfortunately passed away a few days later after I read that. But I just thought it would be so good to have a podcast just talking about just the so many ways that he has impacted the wider church, and also like just the city of New York, and I can think of so many ways in which he's impacted people outside the church, but specifically within the church, he's made such a huge impact, and I think it would just be good to honor his life and just talk about his theology, his him as a person and what he did. And we're probably people that are outside his regular circles in terms of being charismatic and from that world, but I think it's such a testament to who he was that he's impacted us so much. So, yeah, I just think it would be good to just talk about the ways he's impacted us. Maybe some ways we didn't land on the same places, but still how his legacy is going to be continued too.
Yeah, I mean, that Sized Cultures document, which we can link in the description, is for anybody who's involved in church leadership over the last 15 years, that might be a PDF that people have read, talking about the different ways to lead a church at the different size, all the way what he goes from like the house church, small group setting, starting out there, working its way through 100 people, 150 people, 500 people, and then the larger mega church world. Helpful document. Let's talk about his impact. Like for me, when I was in seminary, I had a class, a homiletics class actually, that required that we listen to Keller and Edmund Clowney they did a class that was available. I think the MP3s are still available, about preaching Christ in a postmodern context. And really interesting, really good. A lot of great insights into it. So that was pretty influential for me. And then The Reason for God, his book, it's been considered like a modern day C.S. Lewis, kind of an apologetic for a Christian faith. Mm-hmm. The Prodigal God, another really great book of his. And then City, I think, what is it? Center Church. I've got it right now, right next Center to me.
This,
Church. Yep. Yeah, this really thick book here. I remember getting this and reading it the first time about, you know, gospel-centered ministry in the city. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of great thoughts on culture, as you had kind of said. But what are some of the ways that Keller influenced you?
Well, I'll talk about more recently, actually, when I was sort of doing my chaplaincy residency. I think one of the hardest things I was grappling with was like how to understand hope when you're surrounded by so much tragedy. And I was really struggling with that. But Keller's writings on just the idea that we don't have to erase the sadness or the mourning that can come when we lose people tragically, or when stuff doesn't go the way we want it to go in life, or anything like that, that doesn't negate the hope that we have. Mm. And there's been a viral clip that's actually been going around recently about him talking about this. And he said, at the end of the day, it all comes down on the resurrection. And I love this because it just shows how he applies this to so many different areas, like Reason for God. Like, I remember that was like such a big thing, like for his thing was like, it all comes down to the resurrection. And he used that to prove like why God exists, but then also it also shows why we can still rely on God and have hope, because I think he said at the end of the day, if the resurrection is true and Jesus was resurrected, it means everything's going to be okay. He was like, I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. We have a slight idea in Revelation, but at the end of the day, we can know that, look, everything is going to be okay. And that was really helpful for me. And that had an impact on me, you know.
Yeah, that's
great. So, yeah, that was very, very helpful.
Just him rooting a lot of, a significant bulk of Christian hope and resurrection being a big influence for you.
Yeah, totally. And also, I didn't realize this, but did you know that he only started being published 15 years ago?
It seemed like about 15 years ago is about when it was like, oh, there's this guy.
I mean, that it's not like he just started his work 15 years ago. I mean, obviously that had been a lifetime of work leading up to that, but it just was also just so refreshing to hear that, because I feel like the current culture with like pastors and celebrity pastors is like, you have to churn out a book or you have to write something, and you know, you're in your 20s or 30s and
it's too late. You're 31.
Exactly. It's like, oh my gosh. So just hearing that and just made me think how it for him, it must have been just coming from a place of deep lived experience. You know, he has experienced a lot at that point, and just probably speaks to why his writings come across with so much wisdom and depth. And, you know, he's not writing from a place that he's not experiencing in a way.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating thinking about him, you know, being super faithful as a pastor for decades, you know, and then kind of through, I think probably, you know, which we should talk about obviously eventually, is the Gospel Coalition, because he's a founding member of that website and resource center. And there's obviously a lot that they put out that I find very not convincing, but also for me, there was early on, it felt like there were a lot of great resources before they got kind of, I don't know, somewhat hijacked by the reformed resurgence, so to speak. That's interesting. You know, something I really found helpful for me was, his, you know, the reason for God, it seemed like he did a really good job of presenting Christianity, not in a way that was like, hey, look at, you know, Christianity is super, super reasonable because it's not at all challenging. You know, what it felt like was that he wrote a defense to show that the Christian worldview is not crazy, though, you know, like it's rooted in historical event, the resurrection being one of them, but then also the way that he wrestled with how, I mean, his approach to the Bible and science, you know, like you can actually be a faithful Christian and also accept some findings from science. And I know that's super debatable, you know, somewhat about creation narratives, but I felt like he did a good job of navigating that, because it's really telling that he had so many people in his church in Manhattan, which, you know, oftentimes is considered a super progressive, you know, liberal location, you know, and there's conservative Reformed Presbyterian church right in the middle of it that's got, you know, 5,000 plus members. So,
and that's planting churches and helping equip other churches. And I mean, it's crazy to think about just the amount of hats that he was able to wear seamlessly, like a church planner, evangelist, theologian, philosopher in a way. Like I remember watching a talk of him and he just spoke about Immanuel Kant like it was nothing, like he just knew him really well. And that is extremely rare. And I don't know. He was just such a gift to the church in that way, you know?
Yeah. And didn't he, I'm looking right now, but I think he actually spoke at Google at some point in time. Yeah. He spoke at Google, you know? And so one of the things that people critique him on is that he, which I don't at all buy into this critique about him, is that he was just, you know, like kind of sold out to the cultural narratives of the day. You know, I don't
even know that was a critique. Wow.
Oh, really? Yeah. There's definitely some folks who are, well, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, if you hold to, for example, a hardcore young earth creationism, his being a member of BioLogos and seeming to allow Christians to hold to theistic evolution, then you have to throw out all his perspectives, because, you know, he granted that those were options for Christians to hold to at the very minimum. So it is interesting, though, that he, because in his talks, he certainly didn't shy away from the most controversial aspects of Christianity in today's culture, namely sexual ethics and, you know, and definitely the centrality of Christ and the, you know, the fact that he believed that, you know, Jesus was not an option, you know, one of the ways he held to the exclusivity of Jesus. So that's interesting. Yeah. I do think though that you mentioned the size cultures, what I think you're talking about, how the diversity of hats he wore, it is interesting how he was like a Renaissance man in the sense that he could speak on a lot of topics in a very informed way, you know, across the spectrum of topics. It felt like he didn't seem like he was, you know, how there's some people who, when they speak, it's like they're just talking and they're filling up space about, you know, very little about it, but they're able to, like, through their oratory skills, you know, he did seem to have a pretty strong grasp on a lot of different things, which leads me to believe he probably read a lot of books and engaged in thinking on a wide spectrum of topics,
and could just talk to any audience, like non-church people, church people, and within the church or like different denominations. And you know, I think that's really, really impressive. And I mean, probably like the biggest, and just like reading so many people's tributes to him, it really, at the end of the day, all those hats or whatever wouldn't be as influential, or he wouldn't be as influential if all those giftings weren't grounded in his character. I mean, we've done a podcast last week on that issue within leaders, and he was just grounded in a really good character, and just who he was. And I think that probably was the anchor that brought him through ministry was just his ability to anchor himself in his relationship with God, and just his character formation throughout of that was like he really held to that, which is really impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Barring some scandalous thing that gets exposed over the next, you know, decade.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
It seems like he, I mean, the amount of people who have written tributes about him from people who held to, you know, vastly different theological perspectives, yet recognized in him a sense of humility, a sense of, I mean, he was a servant leader. He was caring. He wasn't trying to be, you know, famous in the sense of, you know, like, you know, trying to further his personification as a as an evangelical superstar says a lot about him. Yeah, it seemed like I was actually surprised at how many people that I would assume did not like him at all theologically had to after his passing, you know, write some form of an encouragement about his lasting impact in the way that he interacted with people, because I think that's like that's tough to do, I think, with people. I mean, I know I obviously struggle at times not, you know, getting into it because of ideas that are so harmful. He seemed like he was able to do that in a way that was gracious and and yet you didn't, you know, everybody knows he held to perspectives that obviously were controversial at times.
Yeah. Well, what talking about that, what were some of the things for you that you sort of drifted away from him with in terms of theologically or some of the,
well, it's interesting because, you know, as someone who was trained within a Reformed theological environment that had a high, high view of Keller, you know, he was obviously, I think for me, I think he represented the type of Reformed theology that was attractive to me ongoing in a way, because he never seemed to be like, I mean, you would never catch him saying something like Arminians aren't Christians, whereas there's plenty of Reformed people that would, you know, say something as stupid as that, like Douglas or John Piper or something. But, you know, I think definitely as I engaged in scripture and studied more theology and read, I mean, his complementarianism was something that I was not convinced of. His wife actually, interestingly, you know, and there's this little series that was put out, I think it was put out by Zondervan. I could be wrong about that, but there's a little book that Michael Bird contributed to, another scholar wrote to, but Tim Keller's wife, I think, wrote the complementarian perspective. You know, and he's obviously spoken a lot about it. So complementarianism would be one. I think the nature to which he didn't speak out a little bit on the debate about justification with N.T. Wright and E.A. Carson, for instance. I've heard some lectures where he seemed to be, you know, kind of in line with the Reformed perspective a bit. And I felt like it could have, I would have liked to have had him reflect a little bit on it, because especially as a cultural critic in some ways, I think he probably could have seen how N.T. Wright's work was actually really helpful for the cause of the gospel. You know, just in that, I think N.T. Wright was observing that the caricatures that were believed and held by a lot of Reformed people needed to be undermined a bit. But and then, I mean, the Gospel Coalition, that was, I think that the idea behind that is brilliant. The amount of resources they put out over the years has been like, man, it's really inspiring. But the brand that seems to have arisen in the last, at least the last seven to 8 years, has just been so, I don't know, like, I don't want to use the word fundamental. Yeah, in many ways, there's been some really like, whoa, that's, I mean, Joshua Butler's recent foray into writing has been probably the clearest example of worse
that it came from the Tim Keller. The new Tim Keller. I mean, that was, I mean, he didn't probably have anything to do with that, but it's just such a shame that that was associated.
I just would hope that they would have had maybe more constructive I don't know, maybe evaluations happening. Yeah, I mean, it just was like, this is bad. This is really bad. And I actually read a fair, somebody, I don't know, even know who did this off the top of my head, but somebody sent me a PDF of more than, it was like five chapters or four chapters. And after reading two, I was like, this is ghastly. I mean, even from if I was a complementarian, this would not at all represent what seemed, I don't want to make any, I don't know the man or his background, but it seemed like there was needing to be some therapy sessions in that.
Are you talking about Butler's book?
Oh, so bad. Yeah.
Oh, God. Gotcha. Yeah.
Not Keller.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's very, that was the first one.
That
makes sense. I think with like the Gospel Coalition, I don't know, and I could have missed it, but I don't know how involved he was when it sort of made that turn. I'm not sure. So I can't, I've never known how to associate that with him. I can't be like, oh, did Keller agree with everything? All the changes that were happening, especially since a lot of those guys so closely associate themselves to Keller, if that makes sense. So I mean,
well, then also too, it's like with him battling cancer the last few years, I would assume he's probably been less involved in a lot of those games. Yeah. So again, I don't know if I can say, and actually somebody critiquing our evaluation of Tim Keller could say, oh, you guys are doing this against Tim Keller, and I want to make sure. No, I mean, like, there's so many things that Keller overwhelmingly appreciate his work, and yet at the same time, too, I don't think you can disentangle Keller from being a part of that, and I just wonder if, especially given the trajectory of evangelicalism in today's world, if it really was smart to continue to hold complementarianism as a central part of the gospel. And I understand complementarians view it as a gospel issue, but I oftentimes that's positioned in a way where it's like egalitarians don't accept the authority of scripture, and we've given ourselves over to cultural blowing cultural wind. But for me, I can speak for myself and for many other egalitarians that I know, it's because of biblical hermeneutics, exegeting scripture in their context and wrestling with the implications of those things that we hold to non-complementarian theology. So I just think that's a bummer, because I think there's a lot of people like us who have a high value for Tim Keller that would be both advocates and also we would be partners in ministry, but we're not allowed to be because we hold to a specific position on women in ministry. That to me is weird.
Yeah. What do you mean by we're not allowed to be? Like, there's women that wouldn't be able to partner with him to the fullest.
Yeah. Or even, I mean, very few egalitarians have written resources for the Gospel Coalition, Acts 29, which I know Acts 29 and Gospel Coalition are separate entities, but within that world, people who hold to egalitarian, and I mean evangelical egalitarian, i.e. holding to the centrality of Christ, to the necessity of salvation by grace through faith, holding to the authority of scripture, those people are kept out of that circle. And I remember when I held to complementarianism, I shared some of those concerns as a complementarian, but as I studied, I determined that was an unfounded position to hold to, because there were tons of egalitarians who were conservative on biblical scholarship, who held to conservative traditional sexual ethics, who had a high view of salvation by grace through faith, all those things. So so that's not really a critique of Keller. It's more just an observation about the circles that he tended to run in, and just wishing he maybe had spent more time amongst other folks who had things to contribute, but also things that they could have received more from him. Because I feel like a lot of people in outside of the Reform world, I've heard many actually so Arminian leaning folks say things like Tim Keller's like the only reason why I have any hope for the Reformed evangelical world. I've read that and heard that. And I think there's a lot of people though also who would just dismiss Keller because of his association with those folks. Whereas I would say The Reason for God is to this date still, I think, probably one of the best defenses for the Christian worldview. Out there. I mean, I've given away that book to dozens of people and recommended it to so many people because it's really good. It answers so many questions that are actually being asked.
I mean, it's almost like it's very close to like the mere Christianity of our time, isn't it? It's like almost,
I think it is.
It pretty much is. I feel like that, I feel like that is probably speaking to what I was feeling in this, in terms of just not that he's responsible for it, but I just wish he had distanced himself a little bit more from that toxic culture that he was so closely and helped create, not the toxic culture, but that organization.
Yeah.
It would have been really helpful, I think, for a lot of people.
It probably would have had a greater impact than, I mean, imagine the impact he has already. I think that's true. So
I think about like, you know, sort of in a similar vein, like when Rachel Held Evans died, right? I feel like there were a lot of people, just like we're talking about Keller, had people from both sides attributing like he lived a good, like faithful life. Like, even though Rachel Held Evans probably came on the other side of the, on the theological spectrum on a lot of things, she lived a life that spoke to a lot of people, and a lot of people were able to recognize that. And I think when people are either on one camp or the other, I think just like, let me just say this. I think there is sort of this thing of, if you can speak to something that isn't going well within your circles that you're so closely aligned with, it makes a big impact. You know what I mean? And I say that because I would like to think that someone like Rachel Held Evans also would have called out people in her own tribe if she saw something like, you know. So anyways, that's all.
You're far more gracious to her than I am. not
that's another episode.
I'm totally kidding. Yeah. No, I'm somewhat joking. Cause she's such a polarizing figure amongst Christians, but and it's like, you know, if you talk bad about people who have passed away, then it's bad. And if you give glowing, well, it's so hard now because it's like, people assume that if you have something positive to say about somebody, then you must affirm everything they've ever said or done, you know, and that's an interesting thing. Observation I've seen about Keller is, like we had said, it was interesting reading all the different tributes that were written to him from people who did not agree with him in many areas. And then it was interesting to see how there were a lot of people who wanted to cancel him essentially because of the challenge we're talking about, some of the toxicity that existed in some of the circles that he tended to run through. And then you had some people who just didn't like him at all because they couldn't affirm anything that he held to or viewed or, you know, any of his work. And it's interesting because I read somewhere from somebody, they were observing how many, this is, I thought, kind of interesting, is that almost, a great deal of the tributes that were written about him always had the person who's writing the tribute as a central figure of the story. And it is interesting how we do that. I do. It's like, you know, somebody's impact on me, and it's like, but you know, like, what does that have to do with the actual, you know, tribute, I guess, or whatever. I don't know. It just was interesting how, so, cause I wonder if this is getting to the issue of social media has curated a culture that is all narcissists, right? Where we, you know, we get on social media to tell people what we think. We all do it, you know?
So
it's like, I have to let you know about Tim Keller's passing and how he impacted me so that I can be the hero of Tim Keller's story.
That's so true.
So I mean, that's, we say this tongue in cheek as we're recording a podcast about Tim Keller's impact on us.
Yeah. And Amelia has something to say too. What do you like? She's been ironing out this microphone. She's ready to start speaking.
She's ready to say.
Yeah. No, I agree. Well, with that being said, what, like, in terms of just Tim, not how he impacted us, but what do you think are some of the things that the church is going to take away and is going to be his lasting legacy that we're going to see come up again and again and again?
Definitely. Well, man, I hope that his willingness and concern for the church to engage culture would be one of them.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about some of the things that, going back to Center Church, that I found really fascinating when I read it, had to do with his focus on missional communities, and how he has a whole chapter on connecting people to the culture, which I thought really interesting, you know. And it seemed like when he was writing, you know, he was always working hard in his thinking to encourage the church to exegete scripture and exegete culture, and wanting to help people. I mean, like, many of the questions that he was raising in The Reason for God, for example, at that time were some of the primary questions that people were asking, you know. I mean, science in the Bible would be one of the main ones, or the existence of evil and suffering alongside, you know, the goodness of God.
Yeah.
I think that would be one major one. And then I do want to, I guess, you know, go back into The Reason for God and just the commitment to presenting a holistic, winsome, you know, robust defense of the Christian faith. I mean, I feel like that is something that we still need to be committed to. I mean, he didn't hold to an anti-intellectual Christianity. You know, he felt that there were really good reasons why, when you look at all the different reasons why the resurrection story took place, you know, he was able to say, if you analyze all of them, the resurrection, the most plausible, reasonable explanation was that Jesus was in fact raised from the dead and was seen by numerous, you know, literally hundreds of witnesses. And so I've always found that super inspiring about him, is that he wasn't willing to concede or say things like, oh, you just have to believe in your heart, you know, and just, you know, have blind faith. It was like his faith was rooted in historical events and, you know, methods of probability to determine whether or not one should hold to those views. And yet, at the same time, as you mentioned earlier, he did still have a deeply spiritual faith to him, you know, in an acknowledgement that there was hope and faith connected into something greater than what we can observe and see. And so I just found those things inspiring. How about yourself?
Gosh, I've been thinking about this, and to contrast him with someone like C.S. Lewis, say, I feel like with C.S. Lewis, I feel like people reference C.S. Lewis for his works and how good they were and how great they were. And I'm not sure that will be the same with Keller, in the sense that we're going to go, oh, like this book or that's, I feel like it's who he was that's going to have the biggest impact, that's going to live on in a sense with people and leaders in the church specifically. I think they're going to go, man, I want to be like Tim Keller, if that makes sense. Not
interesting.
Wrote a book like Tim Keller's book, which I bet some people will be like, oh, I wish I wrote that book, that C.S. Lewis book, because it's so good, right? Yeah. And that's not to discount C.S. Lewis at all, like, as
him as a person. What do you think about that? I just as you're saying that, I'm not a C.S. Lewis scholar by any means, you know, in fact, I've read many of his books, but I can't think of anybody who was a disciple of C.S. Lewis, and maybe I'm wrong. I'm sure there are some, but I can't think of any, you know, theologians or people who were like direct disciples of C.S. Lewis's personal. Yeah, there's many people who are super influenced by C.S. Lewis's writings. Whereas with Tim Keller, there are virtually dozens upon dozens upon dozens of people who say, "Hey, Tim Keller had an indelible impact on my life and my leadership, you know? So it's almost like Tim Keller may not be as well known in his name as C.S. Lewis in the future, but he may have had a greater impact due to the amount of leaders that he loved and mentored and raised up, which I know is different because C.S. Lewis wasn't that, but so it's kind of comparing apples and oranges, but it is an interesting difference there.
No, I think that's, I mean, that I think you're spot on with that. Like, I've read so many stories of people just like, similar to like when Dallas Willard died, there were just so many stories of people of like unknown stories of how Dallas Willard like helped people out that no one knew about. And it's similar
like in his classrooms or in the local church
or local church and
or driving. Thing. I mean, there's driving, I've heard stories about the way he impacted people on the side of a road. I actually have heard several stories about that.
No, like, exactly. I think that's going to be the same with Tim, I think just the amount of stories that are going to come out over the years about what he did for people is probably going to be the thing that is his lasting legacy, which I think is an amazing thing. And I think is what we all really want to be striving towards, because not everyone's going to write books. Mm-hmm. And I think what we can all leave behind is the people that we were and like how we lived our lives for Jesus in a way, and how we pointed people to Jesus and stuff, which I think is what Tim Keller was about and what his legacy is going to be about.
That's good. That's really good. Yeah. I mean, it seems like that would be one of the primary things that we can celebrate about Tim Keller. And yeah, in many ways it's kind of sad that we don't have that voice in the church anymore, because it, you know, having somebody to wrestle with big cultural thing. What do you think about this? And this is maybe we can wrap up with this topic. Yeah. You know, he seemed to be, it's interesting how he, and I have a lot of appreciation for this third wayism of his engaging with politics. And it's funny because you have people on the right and people on the left who, this is where they seem to critique him is you know, the both and perspective versus the either or, you know. But for me, he was really helpful in navigating, because I always felt like he did a good job of reminding us that our allegiance is to Jesus and the kingdom versus political parties. And it's interesting because advocates of certain political parties don't like that. That's, you know, one of my takeaways too.
No, I think that's very true. And I think especially coming from our background in the Vineyard and King, like being so rooted in both and terminology and stuff, that really resonated a lot with me and the way that he did things. Like, it seems like an easy way out. And I think that some of the critique is like, it's almost like an easy way out. But I think actually that third way of holding that tension is actually extremely difficult and a lot harder than just saying, oh, it's Beth Ann. But actually living that out is really, really tough. And he really did that.
Yeah. Cause it's, I remember he was quoting somebody, but it's like, when you mix Christianity with politics, you get politics.
That's so good.
And
that's to say that he's not saying Christianity or like it's not political. Just to clarify.
I think that's right. Well, that's what I'm always, it's like, no, the kingdom of God is deeply political because it's oriented around the kingdom, which you know, makes it, for me, it's really hard to align with any political party because of there's problems on both ends of the spectrum. And then at the same time too, I do understand, as one who probably is more conservative and has become increasingly more conservative politically over the last 3 years, while still not being able to co-sign, you know, into a party, it's like, man, it's really a challenge to figure out how to live this out due to the craziness around us. And I think that I just appreciated that about him. But I also understand why there are, you know, many people on the right and the left that was one major criticism they had of him too. Yeah. But it's like, you can't really please everybody is kind of what what it seems like.
Totally. Yeah. Especially when you become as famous as he did. So
well, that's good.
That was a bonus episode, everybody. We just felt like it would be good just to do an episode just talking about and honoring Keller's life. And if you were with us on our last episode, we spoke about how we are going to be producing new content, hopefully on a weekly basis, but we're going to be writing more articles to go along with each episode that comes out. And then we're also going to be creating content for paid subscribers. So you can sign up to our Substack, as well as you can put in your email and it will produce free content. But then we're also going to be producing content for our paid members too. And so if you would like to be part of that, you're more than we would love for you to be part of that. Let me just say that. And then also just subscribing to our social media channels, YouTube, and Facebook and Twitter. We've got an Instagram account now.
You're going to need to manage those. And then when you get your TikTok going, you can do dance reels.
Yeah. Well,
about Tim Keller.
I'm just hoping Amelia is going to be able to take over that one for us. So, thanks everybody for joining us today. Luke, do you want to end us off?
So I do this to you all the time, and now you do it back to me. That is so terrible. I will end with this. For anybody listening, it is very encouraging that finally, at the end of season 3, Wes McLaughlin has figured out how to actually do his microphone correctly. His audio, he selected the right mic.
We got it going, guys. We got it going.
He's the most untechnologically advanced millennial I've ever met in my life, and it's very encouraging. So, yeah. But thanks for listening, and we'll talk to y'all soon. Woo!